This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Freitag ist Euro-Jackpot-Tag. Jetzt im Jackpot rund 75 Millionen Euro. Das Leben könnte so Jackpot sein. In jeder Lotto-Annahmestelle und auf lottobayern.de. Lotto Bayern, nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18, Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bzga.de.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 5th of February. The UN Secretary-General has warned against ethnic cleansing as Trump administration officials have spent the day qualifying the US president's proposal to take over Gaza and for Palestinians to leave the territory. We'll get the latest from Washington and reaction from Gaza and Saudi Arabia. Also, is Kemi Badenoch's time of reflection at an end as the Conservative Party leader announces a new immigration policy? We have reaction to the news that the government has decided to take down Grenfell Tower. We have a report on the reconstruction of Mosul in northern Iraq and hear about a new film about the impact of the war in Ukraine on nature. After their boss's jaw-dropping proposal to take over the Gaza Strip and turn it into what he called a Riviera of the Middle East, Trump administration officials have spent the day fielding questions, trying to clear up some of the many ambiguities about Mr. Trump's controversial and unexpected comments last night. As the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned against ethnic cleansing, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio qualified Mr. Trump's comments about Gaza's residents being relocated.
Gaza has been severely damaged. If you look at the aerial imagery, you see what's happening. The billions of dollars that are going to be required for reconstruction are enormous. Some areas have been rendered unlivable, now and for the foreseeable future. And so what President Trump announced yesterday is the offer, the willingness of the United States to become responsible for the reconstruction of that area. And while you are rebuilding, while you're clearing debris, by the way, there are unexploded munitions. There are all kinds of Hamas weaponry still buried underground. For people to be able to live in a place safely, all of that has to be removed. It's an enormous undertaking.
And in the last couple of hours, the White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was asked how the president's proposals aligned with his America First policy, which is against involvement in foreign wars.
The president has not committed to putting boots on the ground in Gaza. He has also said that the United States is not going to pay for the rebuilding of Gaza. His administration is going to work with our partners in the region to reconstruct this region. And let me just take a step back here, because this is an out-of-the-box idea. That's who President Trump is. That's why the American people elected him. And his goal is lasting peace in the Middle East for all people in the region.
Well, our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman was at that news conference and joins us now from the White House. And Tom, you asked a question about that key point of contention, the status of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Yes, I asked Karoline Leavitt, would she confirm that any or all Palestinians who wish to remain on their land in Gaza would be able to do so? Now, notably, she did not directly address that point. She swerved the question and said that President Trump's plan involves providing accommodation temporarily for people to be relocated. But the fundamental point was this was a question that would have allowed the White House to rule out the forcible displacement of Palestinians, because the key point about that is it would be illegal under international law. It's a clear breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, to which the US is a signatory, to forcibly displace populations. So she didn't address that point and didn't take that opportunity to rule it out. So I think it's abundantly clear now that the element of compulsion in this is a clear part of the Trump plan for Gaza.
And what about the reaction to this in America? I'm thinking from within the Republican Party, because comment by Karoline Leavitt we played there in answer to the question about how does this fit in with the America First policy points at the fact that some close allies of Donald Trump in Congress are pretty uncomfortable about this idea of potentially sending American troops, although she said there's no commitment to that, to a foreign country.
Absolutely. I mean, unsurprisingly, today on Capitol Hill, there's been, an outpouring of horror from Democrats, frankly, about this whole plan. They believe it drives a wedge through the two-state solution, the, traditional formula for a compromise between Israelis and Palestinians. One congressman, Democrat, saying that Trump had, in his words, lost it. But I think more worrying, you would expect that largely from the Democrats, I think more worrying for President Trump is that it is also dividing Republicans, including some key allies of his, not least Lindsey Graham, who is also fiercely loyal to the current Israeli leadership, saying that he likened the situation to that in Lebanon in 1983, where many American troops' lives were lost at the hands of Hezbollah and other armed groups, saying that, you know, Mr. Trump had promised that there wouldn't be entanglements in foreign wars. That was the America First pledge to the electorate. And here he was appearing to suggest that American troops could be sent to seize Gaza and take control of it. So I think that is causing deep concern among some Republicans. And that is something Mr. Trump hasn't directly addressed since his news conference of yesterday.
Is there a consensus forming then, Tom, at this point, as to what is behind this proposal? Is it a serious proposal? Is it, as some have suggested, essentially something for the Israeli government, a protection, if you like, for Benjamin Netanyahu, or part of a wider negotiation?
Well, that is becoming, you know, increasingly the absolutely key question here, because of course, we have to take it seriously. This is being proposed by the President of the United States. Now, beyond that, the proposals themselves are clearly, to any objective observer, totally unworkable. I mean, the notion of forcing out, even if it was, say, a million Palestinians from their land, would be both, you know, illegal under international law and seen as deeply immoral. And to be proposed, of course, by the United States, deeply problematic, as most many Western countries in the Arab world have pointed out all day today. So what is Mr. Trump doing? I mean, there is an interpretation or a theory, I suppose, that this may be a kind of classic maximalist negotiating position to say that effectively this is now the new end goal for Gaza as far as the Americans are concerned, that they have killed off the two-state solution, but also killed off any sort of Palestinian-led governance future for Gaza. But it may be that Mr. Trump wants to use that as leverage to row back on that, to get something he wants out of other players in the region. Now, that could be the Saudis for a normalization deal with Israel. It could be the Iranians in terms of a nuclear deal with the Americans. I have to say, a lot of this is, I mean, this is all clearly pure speculation because we don't know what is motivating Mr. Trump. The other possibility is it's simply he's been convinced to do this by those within his administration that have an ideological connection and sympathy with the ultra-nationalist far-right settler movement within Israel.
Tom, many thanks. Our correspondent Tom Bateman joining us from the White House there. Well, the mooted plan has been welcomed by the Israeli government, but the reaction around the world bears little relation to Donald Trump's assertion today that everybody loves it. There's been a mixture of head-scratching, scepticism and outright rejection of the idea of removing Palestinians from Gaza, and there's been much concern that even floating this idea could cause the collapse of the current fragile ceasefire deal. Now, I've been speaking to Abia Barakat. She's an English lecturer and she lives in Gaza City. And she gave me her reaction to Mr. Trump's comments.
It's absolutely absurd. It shows that he's not just a president. He's a real estate businessman. And I believe that we Palestinians, we have lived through all the horrors of the genocide. We deserve to have some kind of peace to build our own lives again, not to have another plan to displace the Palestinians from in Gaza outside. What he said is against international law, and this shows how his colonial ideas are manifesting themselves.
Do you take it seriously? Are people taking it seriously there? Because some people are saying this is simply a negotiating tactic.
For me, I take every statement seriously. I think about all these statements. I think about everything that's going on. If you don't take it seriously, this means you cannot face it properly. So I think all the international communities, including the Arab countries, all of them should come together, have some kind of a meeting and discuss how can they encounter such statements.
Tell us a bit, if you will, Abir, about your neighborhood. What does it look like now? Mm.
My neighborhood is simply like all the neighborhoods in Gaza. 80% of Gaza houses have been destroyed. Right now, I'm not living in the original neighborhood that my house is. two stories of the building we are staying in are destroyed. So we are struggling in this kind of life. We have no water tanks on the roof, so we try to carry water up to the apartment and place it for our own usage. We have two types of water, clean drinking water and everyday use water.
How difficult is it going to be to rebuild your place and the entire area where you live, and indeed the entire Gaza Strip?
Of course it's very difficult. However, this is not the first time that Gaza has been destroyed and rebuilt. I have lived during every incursion, every aggression on Gaza. I was born in the 1980s, so I have lived through the first intifada, the second intifada, and all the attack, the Israeli attacks on Gaza. And I have seen how many houses and buildings have been destroyed and how the people of Gaza were resilient and they were able to rebuild it.
Do you think there are people though in Gaza who would be happy, as Donald Trump has suggested, to live elsewhere while Gaza is rebuilt?
Of course not. We are not happy about what he just planted. This is not feasible. This is not realistic. We are not going to repeat the mistake of our ancestors. We are not going to repeat the 1948. We are the own people and we are the righteous owners of this land. So if it's going to be rebuilt, it's going to be rebuilt with our own hands, with our own abilities.
And when you say the mistakes of your ancestors, you are talking about what happened 1948.
During the Nakba.
Yes. Just explain what your ancestors did, what the mistakes they made were, in your opinion.
Their mistake was to be terrified by the Zionist gangsters who committed heinous massacres in the villages around them. So they were scared. Also, when they started bombarding around their villages, so they evacuated and they escaped from their properties, from their land, from their homes. They thought that they are going to come back to it when everything settles down, but they discovered that it was a one-way trip. My grandmother was forcefully expelled from Jaffa, what's now called Jaffa. She continued telling me stories about that. She kept saying that if it was up to me right now, I wouldn't leave it. So I applied her advice not to leave. I stayed on Gaza. I didn't evacuate to the south, and I'm not going to evacuate outside of Palestine.
There is a lot of discussion about how this plan or this ambition that Donald Trump has spoken about might happen. There's talk about American troops being involved. I mean, if they came to Gaza, what would they meet?
They are going to meet the resilience and the resistance of people. If there is any form of resistance, we are going to use every power we have. And I'm not meaning here armed resistance only. I mean every kind of resistance that includes even, for example, this kind of interview that I'm having with you. It's a form of resistance. Writing about it and spreading awareness about it to the international community is resistance. So people are not going to sit and, you know, be helpless. If American troops come, it is going to be invasion. There is no way to beautify this action.
That was Abir Barakat, an English lecturer who lives in Gaza City. Well, Tom Bateman mentioned the idea for Saudi normalization with Israel. Saudi Arabia was one of the fastest countries to publicly reject the idea of displacing Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Riyadh took just 20 minutes to put out a statement to that effect after Donald Trump spoke last night, and to deny Mr. Trump's assertion that the Saudi authorities are not insisting on the creation of a separate Palestinian state. So, how is the kingdom reflecting on the US president's comments today? Ali Shehabi is a Saudi political commentator who has close ties to the royal court.
The thoughts are President Trump can sometimes make hyperbolic suggestions that are not very serious. The idea does not look like it's going to get much traction. Saudi Arabia came out, as you said, very quickly and at 4 a.m. in the morning to make sure that its position was unambiguous. So Saudi Arabia came out also to reiterate that normalization with Israel will only take place post a two-state solution in the region.
But now, do you take it seriously? Do you think it's a genuine plan or is it part of broader negotiations?
I think it's a superficial idea. The danger is that the Israelis will try to take advantage of it. Has Mr. Trump given them an indirect green light or normalized the idea of ethnic cleansing?
What impact, then, do you think this will have on U.S.-Saudi relations?
Look, Saudi Arabia has experience with Mr. Trump. And I mean, they understand that, you know, he says things off the cuff sometimes. He says things that are not very realistic.
This wasn't off the cuff, though, was it? He talked about this a few days ago. He then said it a couple of times in a news conference.
It doesn't seem to have been thought through by his people. How can the U.S. own Gaza? He's going to deploy hundreds of thousands of American troops to clean out Gaza. I mean, the whole thing doesn't make sense. So it's a superficial idea.
What do you think it means then for Arab countries and how they view the ceasefire in Gaza going forward?
We'll have to see. The ceasefire hasn't been discussed. It doesn't bode well. It doesn't bode well for the ceasefire. And certainly it doesn't bode well for normalization, with the normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
What do you think the conversations, the private conversations, are going to be now between people in Saudi Arabia who have direct contact with the Trump administration and those close to President Trump?
They'll be telling them exactly what they said in the public statement. I frankly think that some of Mr. Trump's advisors themselves were not fully aware of this, because discussions between them and between people in the Middle East have not raised this issue in the past.
How is Gaza going to be reconstructed? Who's going to fund it? Is Saudi Arabia going to be part of that? Is it going to be part of the funding effort?
Saudi Arabia said it would be, but it was insisting that this be part of a political process where the Palestinian Authority comes in to take control of Gaza. You know, Netanyahu says he wants to eliminate Hamas. The only way you can eliminate Hamas is to have a political an option, another option, and that has to be the Palestinian Authority.
Is there any temporary way that you, the Saudi Arabia, might accept an American presence, for example, that deals with reconstruction but paves the way for the Palestinian Authority to come in and take over?
If America came in with that objective, which would be quite benign and positive, absolutely.
But then hand it over to the Palestinian Authority.
Then hand it over to the Palestinian Authority.
So there is still a deal to be done, essentially, that would involve the Americans doing the bulk of the reconstruction.
Yeah, but the Americans are not going to do the bulk of the reconstruction. I mean, they're not going to pay for it. So it has to be paid for by, the international community and the Arab states. So it is an extremely complex exercise. And, Mr. Trump has a 4-year tenure. It might take 2 to 3 years just to clear up Gaza.
And that was the Saudi commentator Ali Shihabi. Now, more than 7 years after the Grenfell Tower fire that killed 72 people in West London, the BBC has been told the government has decided to take the tower block down. A meeting was held tonight for the bereaved families and survivors of the fire. It was attended by the Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner. The charred remains of the block have stood shrouded in tarpaulin since June 2017. Well, we're joined now by Emma Dent-Code, who was a Labour MP for Kensington at the time of the fire. She's now an independent councillor on the Kensington and Chelsea Council. And Mushtaq Lashari is a local resident and chairman of Lancaster West Estate Residents Association, which surrounds Grenfell Tower. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Mushtaq Lashari, can I start with you? What do you think of this decision?
I think I'm supportive of it. We were waiting for over 7.5 years for a closure. And I hope this decision will bring a closure. Now, we know that Deputy Prime Minister has met us on 3rd of December and many times. She has visited the area. So I'm a supporter of it because when we surveyed a few years back, overwhelming majority wanted to take it out. And the reason is, because number one, it is dangerous. Number two, it reminds of every day. I live a few yards from it, and I was there on 14th of June, looking into the TV at 1:45, thinking who will form the government. Because if you remember, it was a hung parliament, and everybody was trying to form the government. So when I heard the noise, I went out and I saw people in the tower crying and their relatives standing outside. We tried our best to resolve it, but as you will understand, it was such a dangerous area that police and fire brigade never allowed us to go in. But I think the reason, number one, is it is dangerous. Whenever there is a wind, we are frightened of it, walking near it. And everybody knows that central government and government is spending a lot of money to keep it there. So we are happy that we will have a closure. The residents who are living around it are supportive of it, and I hope it will be done quickly than another 7 years or 7.5 years. Okay. It will be challenging.
Thanks for that. Let me turn to you, Emma Dentcode. I think you're also in favour of this decision, but you must be talking to people in the vicinity, and not all of them will feel the same way.
Absolutely. I am in favour, but I've been very careful not to get involved in any of the local consultations because I live three blocks away. And I think the people who live right there and the people most affected should make that decision. So what we've heard tonight from the people who are at the meeting and obviously news has leaked out all over the place is the Deputy Prime Minister had took her advice from structural engineers and spoke to the residents, as we've heard. And what we have been told that the work will start after the 8th anniversary, which is this coming June, and will be gone by the 10th. So that may take 2 years to deconstruct, as they're calling it. They're not calling it demolition, it's deconstruction, not sure why. Of course, there are massive concerns from the community about public health issues, the impacts of demolition, the noise and the stress they're going through already because their homes are being refurbished. And you know the environmental health impacts, a lot of them already think their health has been impacted by the dust, noise and so on. And will the council be involved in all of this or not? So does it need planning permission or not? There are exemptions. They've decided to keep out of this. So there's a lot still we don't know, but a lot of the bereavement survivors I'm hearing tonight are absolutely distraught. They wanted a different decision. They wanted it to stay. A lot of people regard it as a sacred site. They're absolutely distraught about that.
Well,
and others saying it's what the council wanted. They wanted the building gone, so they'll be happy. So that's not good either.
Well, it's clearly going to be some time until anything, if at all, replaces it. If the whole project of taking it down is going to take at least 2 years. But what are the thoughts in the community about? I mean, maybe it's too early, but I'm sure some people will already have been reflecting on this. What should be there instead?
Well, there's the Grenfell Memorial Commission has been working for some time, and they've got some local representatives from the estate next door, Lancaster West, even though I don't think they have a mechanism for consulting with them. They're already going through a process. So five architecture practices have been selected, and they're going to have an exhibition this spring. In summer, they're going to announce the winner, and then they'll be working on the details of it as the tower is coming down. When they'll start on that work, I don't know. They've been very careful to consult. Again, I've kept well out of it.
Let me jump in then and talk to someone who's presumably not well out of it, because you are the chair of the Lancaster West Estate Residents Association, Mushtaq. What are your thoughts then about what should replace the tower?
I think our concern is that it should not become a tourist area that everybody comes in to look around, and then we will keep on being disturbed. So we want a place, a garden, or some sort of thing which reminds us of the disaster which happened 7.5 years ago. But the residents who are living around, including Kensington Aldridge Academy and KLC, where we use KLC as Kensington Layer Center, where we do gym and all swimming, so they can also forget about it. Obviously, it will be very hard to forget about it, but every year, the bereaved and survivor who are no more living in, less than 10 or 15 people are living in the vicinity of it. All others have moved away. So they can come and remember their loved one who have died. And as I said, I was a local councillor for many years, so I knew everybody. So we, the resident who live around, want something which reminds us of it, but doesn't become a tourist attraction.
That will be a matter of some debate by the sound of things. But thank you very much for joining us, Mushtaq Lashari and Emma Dentcode. Now, the Conservatives say they want a substantial increase in the time that immigrants need to spend in the country before they can be granted British citizenship. They want to increase the period to 15 years from the current 6.
In one of her first policy announcements since becoming the party's leader, Kemi Badenoch says that new conditions for citizenship should be added as well, including having no criminal record and not having claimed benefits or needed social housing. The BBC's political editor Chris Mason sat down with her earlier.
We need to make sure that the people who are coming here want to have a real meaningful connection to the UK. So no criminal records, they should be net contributors to the economy, not relying on benefits, but people who care about our country and care about our communities.
You say that you want to bring the immigration numbers down.
Yes.
Will this do that?
It will. It will certainly make it more sustainable. It should bring numbers down.
Sure.
But it is also making sure that large numbers of people who have come to our country don't automatically get citizenship.
Some will say, well, hang on a minute, if you really want to bring numbers down, it's not about changing the rules once people are here. It's meaning fewer people come here in the first place. Now, I know you've talked about this idea of a legally set down cap.
Yes, that's right.
But there will be people screaming at the television or the radio saying, why not give us the number? And then we can really see if Kemi Badenoch is committed to getting these numbers down.
Well, I do think that we should have a hard cap, but it's also a function of who is coming into our country and who is leaving. A lot of people who come here to gain citizenship would probably leave, that would help, but it also means that the people who are settling in our country are people who want to have a meaningful contribution to it.
Kemi Badenoch speaking to Chris Mason. Well, the Conservative leader had previously suggested that she didn't want to propose concrete policies this far away from a general election. I asked Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt about the Conservative leader's first proactive rather than reactive policy.
Well, that is interesting, isn't it? Because Kemi Badenoch had that long interview with Nick Robinson on Political Thinking, and she said, look, we need to build up trust after that very poor election performance. And also, there has been a problem, she said, in recent years of politicians making specific pledges that they then don't deliver, and that erodes trust. So what is going on here? I think the view in Kemi Badenoch's circle is that she'd never said there wouldn't be no policies, but policies would be announced as part of a full plan, and that this is seen as a first step, an indication of the direction of travel on her plans to fix the immigration system. And interestingly, they do have a pledge to have a fixed cap on visa numbers that would be much lower than the numbers today. Kemi Badenoch is talking about that here, but she's not giving the specific number. So on something as sort of as clear and almost as iconic as that, they're still not getting into specifics.
And the timing of this, Nick, what do you make of it?
Well, obviously, Kemi Badenoch and indeed the Labour Party are clearly facing pressure from Reform UK, from Nigel Farage. There was a poll this week placing Reform UK in first place in Westminster voting intentions. So clearly there's a lot of pressure there. Clearly one of the defining issues of Reform UK is immigration. So some might say, oh, this looks like a panic move in response to reform as we head towards the local elections, the much reduced local elections. I think Kemi Badenoch would say, look, I have said very clearly the government of which I was a member failed on immigration. I've been very clear on that. And here am I consistently talking about this, is what she would no doubt say.
Newsnight's Nick Watt. 8 years after ISIS fighters were driven out of Mosul, a ceremony will take place in the northern Iraqi city tomorrow to mark the reopening of historic buildings that were destroyed in the battle against the jihadists. A project organised and funded by the UN's cultural arm, UNESCO, has employed local people trained in traditional craft skills to carry out the work on mosques and churches in the old city. Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, reports.
The bells of Al-Tahira Church ring out across Mosul, a symbol of the rebirth of the old city that was left devastated 8 years ago after the battle to drive ISIS out.
It was like a ghost town, dead bodies around, sickening smell and horrible scenes of the city and the skyline without the Hadba Minaret. The cityscape is full of rubble. And the River of Tigris, one of the most joyous places around town.
A Mosul photographer, Ali Al-Barudi, recalls the horror that greeted him when he first entered the old city shortly after the street-by-street battle was over in 2017, with the gloriously skewed Al-Hadba minaret, known as the Hunchback, that had been emblematic of Mosul for hundreds of years, in ruins.
It was not the city that we knew. It was like a metamorphosis of not even... We never imagined that, not even in our worst nightmares.
80% of the old city of Mosul and the west bank of the Tigris was destroyed. It was not just the churches, mosques and old houses that needed to be repaired, but the community spirit of those who'd lived there for so long in relative harmony between religions and ethnicities. A year later, the huge task of rebuilding began under the auspices of UNESCO, with a budget of $115 million that the UN Cultural Agency had managed to drum up, much of it from the UAE and the European Union. Father Olivier Poquillon, a Dominican priest, returned to Mosul to help oversee the restoration of the convent of Notre Dame de l'Heure, known locally as Al-Sa'a, which was founded nearly 200 years ago.
We started by the beginning, trying first to gather a team composed of people from old Mosul, from different denominations, Christians, Muslims, working all together. That was the first challenge we had to face. And that was probably the greatest achievement. Because if you want to rebuild a building, you've got first to rebuild trust.
In charge of the entire project, which included the restoration of 124 old houses, has been the architect Maria Rita Akatozo, who came to Mosul straight from restoration work for UNESCO in Afghanistan.
I hope the reconstruction can bring back hope in the affected communities and can favour the recovery of their cultural identity and memory.
8 years on, the major landmarks of Mosul are restored. The wriggling minaret of Al-Hadba, the convent, the church of Al-Tahira, and the complex of Al-Nouri Mosque. And people have been able to return to the houses that have in some cases been home to their families for centuries.
My house was built in 1864. Unfortunately, my house was destroyed partially during the Mosul Pearl liberation, and it was unsuitable to live, especially with my children. So I decided to move to my parents' house. I was very pleased and exciting to see my house rebuilt again.
The scars of what the people of Mosul endured are yet to heal, just as much of Iraq remains in a fragile state. But the rebirth from the rubble of the old city represents hope for a better future.
Sebastian Usher reporting. With the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine approaching later this month, a new Ukrainian film attempts to capture the destruction caused to the country from an unusual perspective. Animals of War is a collection of seven episodes, each featuring a different animal, which tells the story of the war's impact on the natural world. Its producer, Alexei Makhukin, spoke to me from Kiev about the film, and he told me first about the role in one of the episodes of an Oscar-winning Hollywood actor.
So we start from a story which is called Eagle, the story featuring Sean Penn. This is a story of the beginning of the war, when a sound engineer is trying to record unique sounds of birds and eagle in particular.
Hey, give me some good news.
I wish I had some. We have some interference. Did you hear that?
Sound pretty good here.
Yeah, it's helicopter. Now we can record everything.
Awesome, let's do it.
And while doing this, accidentally he recording the very beginning of the war.
So that's the explosion that the sound engineer inadvertently captures, and it marks the beginning of the war. It's heard back in LA by the producer, played by Sean Penn. How did you get Sean Penn to appear in it?
First of all, Sean Penn was supporting Ukraine a lot, and he was doing his own documentary. And so through some friends who worked with him in Ukraine, we managed to connect to him. And he replied one Kyiv morning, which was late night in Lay, that yeah, he is ready to talk about this project. And he quite fast, he agreed to participate. It was really very, very pleasant to work with Sean Penn.
Now, tell us about the rabbit, because the director's rabbit, I understand, actually, well, suffered very directly and died as a result of the war.
Yes, it is done by a young filmmaker. He had his own white rabbit, which helped him during the first months of war. So it was his best friend and emotional connection. And really, he died one day just from heart attack, because animals also have stress from everything what is going on. And this chapter is without words. So it is done in such way. It's another cinematic language. So it's done all without words, only with visuals and music.
Now, filming rabbits, eagles, various animals outdoors is one thing, but filming in an aquarium must have been a bit of a challenge. That's one of the stories, isn't it? Tell us about that.
This story consists of two parts. As a viewer, you start this story just seeing fishes. This is a fairy tale told by a brother to his younger sister, because they are sitting in an aquarium which is located underground, and they're sitting there because of air raid alarm and the boy just entertaining his sister. Filming fishes was difficult, of course, though all animals are difficult to film, but fishes, you cannot direct them at all. So it was a real challenge and craft to find the angles, shots, which we then combine in the story. And you can see it in the film.
I suppose the obvious question people ask is why focus on the animals when there is so much human suffering?
I think there is quite a lot of films and documentaries about human suffering. Probably not all people in Ukraine, and especially outside of Ukraine, realize the scale of, we claim to say that it is ecocide. We give statistics at the final credits of our film that more than 10 million animals have been killed, including 8 million domestic animals, 50,000 dolphins, for example, and millions of birds. It's not only Ukrainian tragedy, but it is influencing the whole continent and probably the whole world. Migration of birds, for example. This humanitarian catastrophe destroys everything around us. And for us, the fact that figures like Sean Penn or Imagine Dragons, we have a soundtrack from them, have joined us in this effort underscores the urgency of addressing this ecocide in Ukraine.
I see a quote from Oleg, the director: animals have no politics, but they can feel good and evil. What is that getting at, do you think?
Of course, it's about animals, but it's also about people, and it's about humans. So how humans behave with animals show how human we are. And animals can feel this, and they can distinguish what is bad or what is good, regardless of any political or whatever situation.
The War Told Through Animals. That was producer Alexei Makuchin. Then the film's called Animals of War. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from all of us here, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.